waiting for shipping orders, and crumbled promptly into ruin every time he finished another tour of duty. Each time he was taken off combat status, he gave a big party for the little circle of friends he had. He broke out the bottles of bourbon he had managed to buy on his 4-day weekly circuits with a courier plane, and laughed, sang, shuffled, and shouted in a festival of inebriated ecstasy until he could no longer keep awake and receded peacefully into slumber. As soon as Yossarian, Nately, and Dunbar put him to bed, he began screaming in his sleep. In the morning, he stepped from his tent looking haggard, fearful, and guilt-ridden, an eaten shell of a human building rocking perilously on the brink of collapse. The nightmares appeared to Hungry Joe with celestial punctuality every single night he spent in the squadron, throughout the whole harrowing ordeal when he was not flying combat missions and was waiting once again for the orders sending him home that never came. Impressionable men in a squadron like Dobbs and Captain Flume were so deeply disturbed by Hungry Joe's shrieking nightmares that they would begin to have shrieking nightmares of their own, and the piercing obscenities they flung into the air every night from their separate places in the squadron rang against each other in the darkness, romantically, like the mating calls of songbirds with filthy minds. Colonel Korn acted decisively to arrest what seemed to him to be the beginning of an unwholesome trend in Major Major's squadron. The solution he provided was to have Hungry Joe fly the courier ship once a week, removing him from the squadron for 4 nights. And the remedy, like all Colonel Korn's remedies, was successful. Every time Colonel Cathcart increased the number of missions and returned Hungry Joe to combat duty, the nightmares stopped, and Hungry Joe settled down into a normal state of terror with a smile of relief. Yossarian read Hungry Joe's shrunken face like a headline. It was good when Hungry Joe looked bad, and terrible when Hungry Joe looked good. Hungry Joe's inverted set of responses was a curious phenomenon to everyone but Hungry Joe, who denied the whole thing stubbornly. "Who dreams?" he answered when Yossarian asked him what he dreamed about.
"Joe, why don't you go see Dr. Nika?" Yossarian advised.
"Why should I go see Dr. Nika? I'm not sick."
"What about your nightmares?"
"I don't have nightmares," Hungry Joe lied.
"Maybe he can do something about them."
"There's nothing wrong with nightmares," Hungry Joe answered. "Everybody has nightmares."
Yossarian thought he had him.
"Every night?" he asked.
"Why not every night?" Hungry Joe demanded.
And suddenly it all made sense. Why not every night, indeed? It made sense to cry out in pain every night. It made more sense than Appleby, who was a stickler for regulations and had ordered Kraft to order Yossarian to take his Adibrin tablets on the flight overseas after Yossarian and Appleby had stopped talking to each other. Hungry Joe made more sense than Kraft, too, who was dead, dumped unceremoniously into doom over Ferrara by an exploding engine after Yossarian took his flight of 6 planes in over the target a second time. The group had missed the bridge at Ferrara again for the 7th straight day with the bombsight that could put bombs into a pickle barrel at 40,000 feet, and 1 whole week had already passed since Colonel Cathcart had volunteered to have his men destroy the bridge in 24 hours. Kraft was a skinny, harmless kid from Pennsylvania who wanted only to be liked and was destined to be disappointed in even so humble and degrading an ambition. Instead of being liked, he was dead, a bleeding cinder on the barbarous pile whom nobody had heard in those last precious moments while the plane with one wing plummeted. He had lived innocuously for a little while and then had gone down in flame over Ferrara on the 7th day, while God was resting, when McWatt turned and Yossarian guided him in over the target on a 2nd bomb run, because Arfi was confused and Yossarian had been unable to drop his bombs the first time.
"I guess we do have to go back again, don't we?"
McWatt had said somberly over the intercom.
"I guess we do," said Yossarian.
"Do we?"
said McWatt.
"Yeah."
"Oh, well,"
sang McWatt.
"What the hell?"
And back they had gone while the planes in the other flights circled safely off in the distance, and every crashing cannon in the Hermann Göring division below was busy crashing shells, this time only at them. Colonel Cathcart had courage and never hesitated to volunteer his men for any target available. No target was too dangerous for his group to attack, just as no shot was too difficult for Appleby to handle on the ping-pong table. Appleby was a good pilot and a superhuman ping-pong player with flies in his eyes who never lost a point. 21 serves were all it ever took for Appleby to disgrace another opponent. His prowess on the ping-pong table was legendary, and Appleby won every game he started until the night Orr got tipsy on gin and juice and smashed open Appleby's forehead with his paddle after Appleby had smashed back each of Orr's first 5 serves. Orr leaped on top of the table after hurling his paddle and came sailing off the other end in a running broad jump with both feet planted squarely in Appleby's face. Pandemonium broke loose. It took almost a full minute for Appleby to disentangle himself from Orr's flailing arms and legs and grope his way to his feet, with Orr held off the ground before him by the shirt front in one hand and his other arm drawn back in a fist to smite him dead. And at that moment, Yossarian stepped forward and took Orr away from him. It was a night of surprises for Appleby, who was as large as Yossarian and as strong, and who swung at Yossarian as hard as he could with a punch that flooded Chief White Half-Oat with such joyous excitement that he turned and busted Colonel Moodus in the nose with a punch that filled General Dreedle with such mellow gratification that he had Colonel Cathcart throw the chaplain out of the officers' club and ordered Chief White Half-Oat moved into Doc Danica's tent, where he could be under a doctor's care 24 hours a day and be kept in good enough physical condition to bust Colonel Moodus in the nose again whenever General Dreedle wanted him to. Sometimes General Dreedle made special trips down from wing headquarters with Colonel Moodus and his nurse just to have Chief White Half-Oat bust his son-in-law in the nose. Chief White Half-Oat would much rather have remained in the trailer he shared with Captain Flume, the silent, haunted squadron public relations officer who spent most of each evening developing the pictures he took during the day to be sent out with his publicity releases. Captain Flume spent as much of each evening as he could working in his darkroom, and then lay down on his cot with his fingers crossed and a rabbit's foot around his neck, and tried with all his might to stay awake. He lived in mortal fear of Chief White Half-Oat. Captain Flume was obsessed with the idea that Chief White Half-Oat would tiptoe up to his cot one night when he was sound asleep and slit his throat open for him from ear to ear. Captain Flume had obtained this idea from Chief White Half-Oat himself, who did tiptoe up to his cot one night as he was dozing off, to hiss portentously that one night when he, Captain Flume, was sound asleep, he, Chief White Half-Oat, was going to slit his throat open for him from ear to ear. Captain Flume turned to ice, his eyes flung open wide, staring directly up into Chief White Half-Oat's, glinting drunkenly only inches away.
"Why?"
Captain Flume managed to croak finally.
"Why not?"
was Chief White Half-Oat's answer. Each night after that, Captain Flume forced himself to keep awake as long as possible. He was aided immeasurably by Hungry Joe's nightmares. Listening so intently to Hungry Joe's maniacal howling night after night, Captain Flume grew to hate him, and began wishing that Chief White Half-Oat would tiptoe up to his cot one night and slit his throat open for him from ear to ear. Actually, Captain Flume slept like a log most nights and merely dreamed he was awake. So convincing were these dreams of lying awake that he awoke from them each morning in complete exhaustion and fell right back to sleep. Chief White Half-Oat had grown almost fond of Captain Flume since his amazing metamorphosis. Captain Flume had entered his bed that night a buoyant extrovert, and left it the next morning a brooding introvert, and Chief White Half-Oat proudly regarded the new Captain Flume as his own creation. He had never intended to slit Captain Flume's throat open for him from ear to ear. Threatening to do so was merely his idea of a joke, like dying of pneumonia, busting Colonel Moodus in the nose, or challenging Dr. Nika to Indian wrestle. All Chief White Half-Oat wanted to do when he staggered in drunk each night was go right to sleep. and Hungry Joe often made that impossible. Hungry Joe's nightmares gave Chief White Halfoat the heebie-jeebies, and he often wished that someone would tiptoe into Hungry Joe's tent, lift Hoople's cat off his face, and slit his throat open for him from ear to ear, so that everybody in the squadron but Captain Flume could get a good night's sleep. Even though Chief White Halfoat kept busting Colonel Moodus in the nose for General Dreedle's benefit, he was still outside the pale. Also outside the pale was Major Major, the squadron commander, who had found that out the same time he found out that he was squadron commander from Colonel Cathcart, who came blasting into the squadron in his hopped-up jeep the day after Major Duluth was killed over Perugia. Colonel Cathcart slammed to a screeching stop inches short of the railroad ditch, separating the nose of his jeep from the lopsided basketball court on the other side, from which Major Major was eventually driven by the kicks and shoves and stones and punches of the men who had almost become his friends.
"You're the new squadron commander,"
Colonel Cathcart had bellowed across the ditch at him.
"But don't think it means anything, because it doesn't. All it means is that you're the new squadron commander."
And Colonel Cathcart had roared away as abruptly as he'd come, whipping the jeep around with a vicious spinning of wheels that sent a spray of fine grit blowing into Major Major's face. Major Major was immobilized by the news. He stood speechless, lanky, and gawking, with a scuffed basketball in his long hands, as the seeds of rancor sown so swiftly by Colonel Cathcart took root in the soldiers around him, who had been playing basketball with him, and who had let him come as close to making friends with them as anyone had ever let him come before. The whites of his moony eyes grew large and misty, as his mouth struggled yearningly and lost against the familiar, impregnable loneliness drifting in around him again, like suffocating fog. Like all the other officers at group headquarters except Major Danby, Colonel Cathcart was infused with the democratic spirit. He believed that all men were created equal, and he therefore spurned all men outside group headquarters with equal fervor. Nevertheless, he believed in his men. As he told them frequently in the briefing room, he believed there were at least 10 missions better than any other outfit, and felt that any who did not share this confidence he had placed in them could get the hell out. The only way they could get the hell out, though, as Yossarian learned when he flew to visit XPFC Wintergreen, was by flying the extra 10 missions.
"I just don't get it," Yossarian protested. "Is Doc Danica right, or isn't he? How many did he say?"
40.
"Danica was telling the truth,"
XPFC Wintergreen admitted.
40 missions is all you have to fly as far as 27th Air Force Headquarters is concerned."
Yossarian was jubilant.
"Then I can go home, right? I got 48.
"No, you can't go home," XPFC Wintergreen corrected him.
"Are you crazy or something?"
"Why not?"
"Catch 22.
"Catch 22?
Yossarian was stunned.
"What the hell has Catch-22 got to do with it?"
"Catch-22,"
Dr. Nika answered patiently when Hungry Joe had flown Yossarian back to Pianosa,
"says you've always got to do what your commanding officer tells you to.
But 27th Air Force says I can go home with 40 missions."
"But they don't say you have to go home. And regulations do say you have to obey every order. That's the catch. Even if the colonel were disobeying a 27th Air Force order by making you fly more missions, you'd still have to fly them, or you'd be guilty of disobeying an order of his. And then 27th Air Force headquarters would really jump on you."
Yossarian slumped with disappointment.
"Then I really do have to fly the 50 missions, don't I?"
he grieved.
"The 55,
Dr. Nika corrected him.
"What 55?
"The 55 missions the colonel now wants all of you to fly."
Hungry Joe heaved a huge sigh of relief when he heard Dr. Nika and broke into a grin. Yossarian grabbed Hungry Joe by the neck and made him fly them both right back to XPFC Wintergreen.
"What would they do to me?"
he asked in confidential tones.
"If I refused to fly them?"
"We'd probably shoot you,"
XPFC Wintergreen replied.
We?
Yossarian cried in surprise. What do you mean, we? Since when are you on their side?
If you're going to be shot, whose side do you expect me to be on?
XPFC Wintergreen retorted.
Yossarian winced. Colonel Cathcart had raised him again. 7. McWatt. Ordinarily, Yossarian's pilot was McWatt, who, shaving in loud red clean pajamas outside his tent each morning, was one of the odd, ironic, incomprehensible things surrounding Yossarian. McWatt was the craziest combat man of them all, probably, because he was perfectly sane and still did not mind the war. He was a short-legged, wide-shouldered, smiling young soul who whistled bouncy show tunes continuously and turned over cards with sharp snaps when he dealt at blackjack or poker until Hungry Joe disintegrated into quaking despair finally beneath their cumulative impact and began ranting at him to stop snapping the cards.
"You son of a bitch! You only do it because it hurts me!"
Hungry Joe would yell furiously as Yossarian held him back soothingly with one hand.
"That's the only reason he does it, because he likes to hear me scream, you goddamn son of a bitch!"
McWatt crinkled his fine, freckled nose apologetically and vowed not to snap the cards anymore, but always forgot. McWatt wore fleecy bedroom slippers with his red pajamas and slept between freshly pressed colored bedsheets, like the one Milo had retrieved half of for him from the grinning thief with the sweet tooth in exchange for none of the pitted dates Milo had borrowed from Yossarian. McWatt was deeply impressed with Milo, who, to the amusement of Corporal Snark, his mess sergeant, was already buying eggs for 7 cents apiece and selling them for 5 cents. But McWatt was never as impressed with Milo as Milo had been with the letter Yossarian had obtained for his liver from Doc Danica.
"What's this?"
Milo had cried out in alarm when he came upon the enormous corrugated carton filled with packages of dried fruit and cans of fruit juices and desserts that two of the Italian laborers Major de Coverley had kidnapped for his kitchen were about to carry off to Yossarian's tent.
"This is Captain Yossarian, sir," said Corporal Snark with a superior smirk. Corporal Snark was an intellectual snob who felt he was 20 years ahead of his time and did not enjoy cooking down to the masses.
"He has a letter from Doc Danica entitling him to all the fruit and fruit juices he wants."
"What's this?"
cried out Yossarian as Milo went white and began to sway.
"This is Lieutenant Milo Minderbinder, sir," said Corporal Snark with a derisive wink. "One of our new pilots. He became mess officer while you were in the hospital this last time."
"What's this?"
cried out McWatt late in the afternoon as Milo handed him half his bedsheet.
"It's half the bedsheet that was stolen from your tent this morning," Milo explained with nervous self-satisfaction, his rusty mustache twitching rapidly. "I bet you didn't even know it was stolen."
"Why should anyone want to steal a bedsheet?" Yossarian asked.
Milo grew flustered.
"You don't understand," he protested.
And Yossarian also did not understand why Milo needed so desperately to invest in the letter from Doc Danica, which came right to the point.
"Give Yossarian all the dried fruit and fruit juices he wants," Doc Danica had written. "He says he has a liver condition."
"A letter like this," Milo mumbled despondently, "could ruin any mess officer in the world."
Milo had come to Yossarian's tent just to read the letter again, following his carton of lost provisions across the squadron like a mourner.
"I have to give you as much as you ask for. Why, the letter doesn't even say you have to eat all of it yourself."
"And it's a good thing it doesn't," Yossarian told him, "because I never eat any of it. I have a liver condition."
"Oh, yes, I forgot,"
said Milo, in a voice lowered deferentially.
"Is it bad?"
"Just bad enough,"
Yossarian answered cheerfully.
"I see,"
said Milo.
"What does that mean?"
"It means that it couldn't be better."
"I don't think I understand."
without being worse. Now do you see?
Yes, now I see, but I still don't think I understand.
Well, don't let it trouble you. Let it trouble me. You see, I don't really have a liver condition. I just got the symptoms. I have a Garnet-Fleischhacker syndrome.
I see, said Milo. And what is a Garnet-Fleischhacker syndrome?
A liver condition.
I see, said Milo, and began massaging his black eyebrows together wearily with an expression of interior pain, as though waiting for some stinging discomfort he was experiencing to go away. In that case, he continued finally, I suppose you do have to be very careful about what you eat, don't you?
Very careful indeed, Yossarian told him. A good Garnet-Fleischhacker syndrome isn't easy to come by, and I don't want to ruin mine. That's why I never eat any fruit.
Now I do see, said Milo. Fruit is bad for your liver?
No, fruit is good for my liver. That's why I never eat any.
Then what do you do with it?
Demanded Milo, plodding along doggedly through his mounting confusion to fling out the question burning on his lips.
Do you sell it?
I give it away.
To who?
Cried Milo in a voice cracking with dismay.
To anyone who wants it! Yossarian shouted back.
Milo let out a long, melancholy wail and staggered back, beads of perspiration popping out suddenly all over his ashen face. He tugged on his unfortunate mustache absently, his whole body trembling.
I give a great deal of it to Dunbar, Yossarian went on.
Dunbar?
Milo echoed numbly.
Yes, Dunbar can eat all the fruit he wants, and it won't do him a damn bit of good. I just leave the carton right out there in the open for anyone who wants to come and help himself. Arfie comes here to get prunes because he says he never gets enough prunes in the mess hall. You might look into that when you've got some time, because it's no fun having Arfie hanging around here. Whenever the supply runs low, I just have Corporal Snark fill me up again. Nately always takes a whole load of fruit along with him whenever he goes to Rome. He's in love with a whore there who hates me and isn't at all interested in him. She's got a kid sister who never leaves them alone in bed together, and they live in an apartment with an old man and woman and a bunch of other girls with nice fat thighs who are always kidding around also. Nately brings him a whole carton full every time he goes.
Does he sell it to them?
No, he gives it to them.
Milo frowned.
Well, I suppose that's very generous of him,
he remarked with no enthusiasm.
Yes, very generous, Yossarian agreed.
And I'm sure it's perfectly legal, said Milo, since the food is yours once you get it from me. I suppose that with conditions as hard as they are, these people are very glad to get it.
Yes, very glad, Yossarian assured him. The two girls sell it all on the black market and use the money to buy flashy costume, jewelry, and cheap perfume.
Milo perked up.
Costume, jewelry? He exclaimed. I didn't know that. How much are they paying for cheap perfume?
The old man uses his share to buy raw whiskey and dirty pictures. He's a lecher.
A lecher?
You'd be surprised.
Is there much of a market in Rome for dirty pictures?
Milo asked.
You'd be surprised. Take Arfie, for instance. Knowing him, you'd never suspect, would you?
That he's a lecher?
No, that he's a navigator. You know Captain Aardvark, don't you? He's that nice guy who came up to you your first day in the squadron and said, Aardvark's my name and navigation's my game. He wore a pipe in his face and probably asked you what college you went to. Do you know him?
Milo was paying no attention.
Let me be your partner,
he blurted out imploringly. Yossarian turned him down, even though he had no doubt that the truckloads of fruit would be theirs to dispose of any way they saw fit once Yossarian had requisitioned them from the mess hall with Dr. Nika's letter. Milo was crestfallen. But from that moment on, he trusted Yossarian with every secret but one, reasoning shrewdly that anyone who would not steal from the country he loved would not steal from anybody. Milo trusted Yossarian with every secret but the location of the holes in the hills in which he began burying his money, once he returned from Smyrna with his plane load of figs and learned from Yossarian that a CID man had come to the hospital. To Milo, who had been gullible enough to volunteer for it, the position of mess officer was a sacred trust.
I didn't even realize we weren't serving enough prunes,
he had admitted that first day.
I suppose it's because I'm still so new. I'll raise the question with my first chef.
Yossarian eyed him sharply.
What first chef? He demanded. You don't have a first chef.
Corporal Snark,
Milo explained, looking away a little guiltily.
He's the only chef I have, so he really is my first chef, although I hope to move him over to the administrative side. Corporal Snark tends to be a little too creative, I feel. He thinks being a mess sergeant is some sort of art form and is always complaining about having to prostitute his talents. Nobody is asking him to do any such thing. Incidentally, do you happen to know why he was busted to private and is only a corporal now?
Yes, said Yossarian. He poisoned the squadron.
Milo went pale again.
He did what?
He mashed hundreds of cakes of GI soap into the sweet potatoes just to show that people have the taste of Philistines and don't know the difference between good and bad. Every man in the squadron was sick. Missions were canceled.
Well,
Milo exclaimed with thin-lipped disapproval.
He certainly found out how wrong he was, didn't he?
On the contrary, Yossarian corrected. He found out how right he was. We packed it away by the plateful and clamored for more. We all knew we were sick, but we had no idea we'd been poisoned.
Milo sniffed in consternation twice like a shaggy brown hare.
In that case, I certainly do want to get him over to the administrative side. I don't want anything like that happening while I'm in charge. You see, he confided earnestly, what I hope to do is give the men in this squadron the best meals in the whole world. That's really something to shoot at, isn't it? If a mess officer aims at anything less, it seems to me, he has no right being mess officer. Don't you agree?
Yossarian turned slowly to gaze at Milo with probing distrust. He saw a simple, sincere face that was incapable of subtlety or guile, an honest, frank face with disunited large eyes, rusty hair, black eyebrows, and an unfortunate reddish-brown mustache. Milo had a long, thin nose with sniffing, damp nostrils heading sharply off to the right, always pointing away from where the rest of him was looking. It was the face of a man of hardened integrity, who could no more consciously violate the moral principles on which his virtue rested than he could transform himself into a despicable toad. One of these moral principles was that it was never a sin to charge as much as the traffic would bear. He was capable of mighty paroxysms of righteous indignation, and he was indignant as could be when he learned that a CID man was in the area looking for him.
"He's not looking for you," Yossarian said, trying to placate him. "He's looking for someone up in the hospital who's been signing Washington Irving's name to the letters he's been censoring."
"I never signed Washington Irving's name to any letters," Milo declared.
"Of course not.
But that's just a trick. To get me to confess I've been making money in the black market."
Milo hauled violently at a disheveled hunk of his off-colored mustache.
"I don't like guys like that, always snooping around people like us. Why doesn't the government get after ex-PFC Wintergreen if it wants to do some good? He's got no respect for rules and regulations and keeps cutting prices on me."
Milo's mustache was unfortunate because the separated halves never matched. They were like Milo's disunited eyes, which never looked at the same thing at the same time. Milo could see more things than most people, but he could see none of them too distinctly. In contrast to his reaction to news of the CID man, he learned with calm courage from Yossarian that Colonel Cathcart had raised the number of missions to 55.
"We're at war," he said, "and there's no use complaining about the number of missions we have to fly. If the colonel says we have to fly 55 missions, we have to fly them."
"Well, I don't have to fly them," Yossarian vowed. "I'll go see Major Major."
"How can you? Major Major never sees anybody."
"Then I'll go back into the hospital."
"You just came out of the hospital 10 days ago,"
Milo reminded him reprovingly.
"You can't keep running into the hospital every time something happens you don't like. No, the best thing to do is fly the missions. It's our duty."
Milo had rigid scruples that would not even allow him to borrow a package of pitted dates from the mess hall that day of McWatt's stolen bedsheet, for the food at the mess hall was all still the property of the government. "But I can borrow it from you," he explained to Yossarian, "since all this fruit is yours once you get it from me with Dr. Danica's letter. You can do whatever you want with it, even sell it at a high profit instead of giving it away free. Wouldn't you want to do that together?"
"No."
Milo gave up.
"Then lend me one package of pitted dates," he requested. "I'll give it back to you. I swear I will. And there'll be a little something extra for you."
Milo proved good as his word and handed Yossarian a quarter of McWatt's yellow bedsheet when he returned with the unopened package of dates and with the grinning thief with the sweet tooth who had stolen the bedsheet from McWatt's tent. The piece of bedsheet now belonged to Yossarian. He had earned it while napping, although he did not understand how. Neither did McWatt.
"What's this?"
cried McWatt, staring in mystification at the ripped half of his bedsheet.
"It's half of the bedsheet that was stolen from your tent this morning," Milo explained. "I bet you didn't even know it was stolen."
"Why should anyone want to steal half a bedsheet?" Yossarian asked.
Milo grew flustered.
"You don't understand," he protested. "He stole the whole bedsheet, and I got it back with the package of pitted dates you invested. That's why the quarter of the bedsheet is yours. You made a very handsome return on your investment, particularly since you've gotten back every pitted date you gave me."
Milo next addressed himself to McWatt.
"Half the bedsheet is yours because it was all yours to begin with, and I really don't understand what you're complaining about since you wouldn't have any of it if Captain Yossarian and I hadn't intervened in your behalf."
"Who's complaining?" McWatt exclaimed. "I'm just trying to figure out what I can do with half a bedsheet."
"There are lots of things you can do with half a bedsheet," Milo assured him. "The remaining quarter of the bedsheet I've set aside for myself as a reward for my enterprise, work, and initiative. It's not for myself, you understand, but for the syndicate. That's something you might do with half the bedsheet. You can leave it in the syndicate and watch it grow."
"What syndicate?"
"The syndicate I'd like to form someday so that I can give you men the good food you deserve."
"You want to form a syndicate?"
"Yes, I do." "No, a mart. You know what a mart is?"
"It's a place where you buy things, isn't it?"
"And sell things," corrected Milo.
"And sell things."
"All my life I've wanted a mart. You can do lots of things if you got a mart. But you got to have a mart."
"You want a mart?
And every man will have a share."
Yossarian was still puzzled, for it was a business matter, and there was much about business matters that always puzzled him.
"Let me try to explain it again,"
Milo offered with growing weariness and exasperation, jerking his thumb toward the thief with the sweet tooth still grinning beside him.
"I knew he wanted the dates more than the bedsheet. Since he doesn't understand a word of English, I made it a point to conduct the whole transaction in English."
"Why didn't you just hit him over the head and take the bedsheet away from him?" Yossarian asked.
Pressing his lips together with dignity, Milo shook his head.
"That would have been most unjust," he scolded firmly. "Force is wrong, and two wrongs never make a right. It was much better my way. When I held the dates out to him and reached for the bedsheet, he probably thought I was offering to trade."
"What were you doing?"
"Actually, I was offering to trade, but since he doesn't understand English, I can always deny it."
"Suppose he gets angry and wants the dates?"
"Well, we'll just hit him over the head and take them away from him,"
Milo answered without hesitation. He looked from Yossarian to McWatt and back again.
"I really can't see what everyone is complaining about. We're all much better off than before. Everybody is happy but this thief. And there's no sense worrying about him, since he doesn't even speak our language and deserves whatever he gets. Don't you understand?"
But Yossarian still didn't understand either how Milo could buy eggs in Malta for 7 cents apiece and sell them at a profit in Pianosa for 5 cents.
Thank you.
8. Lieutenant Shyskov. Not even Clevenger understood how Milo could do that, and Clevenger knew everything. Clevenger knew everything about the war, except why Yossarian had to die while Corporal Snark was allowed to live, or why Corporal Snark had to die while Yossarian was allowed to live. It was a vile and muddy war, and Yossarian could have lived without it, lived forever, perhaps. Only a fraction of his countrymen would give up their lives to win it, and it was not his ambition to be among them. To die or not to die, that was the question, and Clevenger grew limp trying to answer it. History did not demand Yossarian's premature demise. Justice could be satisfied without it. Progress did not hinge upon it. Victory did not depend on it. That men would die was a matter of necessity. Which men would die, though, was a matter of circumstance, and Yossarian was willing to be the victim of anything but circumstance. But that was war. Just about all he could find in its favor was that it paid well and liberated children from the pernicious influence of their parents. Clevenger knew so much because Clevenger was a genius with a pounding heart and blanching face. He was a gangling, gawky, feverish, famish-eyed brain. As a Harvard undergraduate, he had won prizes in scholarship for just about everything, and the only reason he had not won prizes in scholarship for everything else was that he was too busy signing petitions, circulating petitions, and challenging petitions, joining discussion groups and resigning from discussion groups, attending youth congresses, picketing other youth congresses, and organizing student committees in defense of dismissed faculty members. Everyone agreed that Clevenger was certain to go far in the academic world. In short, Clevenger was one of those people with lots of intelligence and no brains, and everyone knew it except those who soon found it out. In short, he was a dope. He often looked to Yossarian like one of those people hanging around modern museums with both eyes together on one side of a face. It was an illusion, of course, generated by Clevenger's predilection for staring fixedly at one side of a question and never seeing the other side at all. Politically, he was a humanitarian who did know right from left and was trapped uncomfortably between the two. He was constantly defending his communist friends to his right-wing enemies and his right-wing friends to his communist enemies, and he was thoroughly detested by both groups, who never defended him to anyone because they thought he was a dope. He was a very serious, very earnest, and very conscientious dope. It was impossible to go to a movie with him without getting involved afterward in a discussion on empathy, Aristotle, universals, messages, and the obligations of the cinema as an art form in a materialistic society. Girls he took to the theater had to wait until the first intermission to find out from him whether or not they were seeing a good or a bad play, and then found out at once. He was a militant idealist who crusaded against racial bigotry by growing faint in its presence. He knew everything about literature except how to enjoy it. Yossarian tried to help him.
"Don't be a dope," he had counseled Clevenger when they were both at cadet school in Santa Ana, California.
"I'm going to tell him," Clevenger insisted, as the two of them sat high in the reviewing stands looking down on the auxiliary parade ground at Lieutenant Shyskov, raging back and forth like a beardless leer.
"Why me?"
Lieutenant Shyskov wailed.
"Keep still, idiot," Yossarian advised Clevenger avuncularly.
"You don't know what you're talking about," Clevenger objected.
"I know enough to keep still, idiot."
Lieutenant Shyskov tore his hair and gnashed his teeth. His rubbery cheeks shook with gusts of anguish. His problem was a squadron of aviation cadets with low morale who marched atrociously in the parade competition that took place every Sunday afternoon. Their morale was low because they did not want to march in parades every Sunday afternoon, and because Lieutenant Shyskov had appointed cadet officers from their ranks instead of permitting them to elect their own.
"I want someone to tell me,"
Lieutenant Shyskov beseeched them all prayerfully,
"if any of it is my fault, I want to be told."
"He wants someone to tell him," Clevenger said.
He wants everyone to keep still, idiot, Yossarian answered.
Didn't you hear him?
Clevenger argued. I heard him, Yossarian replied. I heard him say very loudly and very distinctly that he wants every one of us to keep our mouths shut if we know what's good for us.
I won't punish you, Lieutenant Shishkov swore.
He says he won't punish me, said Clevenger.
He'll castrate you, said Yossarian. I swear, I won't punish you, said Lieutenant Shishkov. I'll be grateful to the man who tells me the truth.
He'll hate you, said Yossarian. To his dying day, he'll hate you.
Lieutenant Shishkov was an ROTC graduate who was rather glad that war had broken out, since it gave him an opportunity to wear an officer's uniform every day and say, "Men!" in a clipped military voice to the bunches of kids who fell into his clutches every 8 weeks on their way to the butcher's block. He was an ambitious and humorless Lieutenant Shishkov, who confronted his responsibilities soberly and smiled only when some rival officer at the Santa Ana Army Air Force Base came down with a lingering disease. He had poor eyesight and chronic sinus trouble, which made war especially exciting for him, since he was in no danger of going overseas. The best thing about him was his wife, and the best thing about his wife was a girlfriend named Dory Does, who did whenever she could, and had a whack uniform that Lieutenant Shishkov's wife put on every weekend and took off every weekend for every cadet in her husband's squadron who wanted to creep into her. Dory Does was a lively little tart of copper, green, and gold, who loved doing it best in tool sheds, phone booths, field houses, and bus kiosks. There was little she hadn't tried, and less she wouldn't. She was shameless, slim, 19, and aggressive. She destroyed egos by the score and made men hate themselves in the morning for the way she found them, used them, and tossed them aside. Yossarian loved her. She was a marvelous piece of ass who found him only fair. He loved the feel of springy muscle beneath her skin, everywhere he touched her the only time she let him. Yossarian loved Dory Does so much that he couldn't help flinging himself down passionately on top of Lieutenant Shishkov's wife every week to revenge himself upon Lieutenant Shishkov for the way Lieutenant Shishkov was revenging himself upon Clevenger. Lieutenant Shishkov's wife was revenging herself upon Lieutenant Shishkov for some unforgettable crime of his she couldn't recall. She was a plump, pink, sluggish girl who read good books and kept urging Yossarian not to be so bourgeois without the R. She was never without a good book close by, not even when she was lying in bed with nothing on her but Yossarian and Dory Does's dog tags. She bored Yossarian, but he was in love with her, too. She was a crazy mathematics major from the Wharton School of Business who could not count to 28 each month without getting into trouble.
"Darling, we're going to have a baby again,"
she would say to Yossarian every month.
"You're out of your goddamn head," he would reply.
"I mean it, baby,"
she insisted.
"So do I."
"Darling, we're going to have a baby again,"
she would say to her husband.
"I haven't the time," Lieutenant Shishkov would grumble petulantly. "Don't you know there's a parade going on?"
Lieutenant Shishkov cared very deeply about winning parades and about bringing Clevenger up on charges before the action board for conspiring to advocate the overthrow of the cadet officers Lieutenant Shishkov had appointed. Clevenger was a troublemaker and a wise guy. Lieutenant Shishkov knew that Clevenger might cause even more trouble if he wasn't watched.
Yesterday it was the cadet officers. Tomorrow it might be the world.
Clevenger had a mind, and Lieutenant Shishkov had noticed that people with minds tended to get pretty smart at times. Such men were dangerous, and even the new cadet officers whom Clevenger had helped into office were eager to give damning testimony against him. The case against Clevenger was open and shut. The only thing missing was something to charge him with. It could not be anything to do with parades, for Clevenger took the parades almost as seriously as Lieutenant Shishkov himself. The men fell out for the parades early each Sunday afternoon and groped their way into ranks of 12 outside the barracks. Groaning with hangovers, they limped in step to their station on the main parade ground, where they stood motionless in the heat for an hour or two with the men from the 60 or 70 other cadet squadrons until enough of them had collapsed to call it a day. On the edge of the field stood a row of ambulances and teams of trained stretcher-bearers with walkie-talkies. On the roofs of the ambulances were spotters with binoculars. A tally clerk kept score. Supervising this entire phase of the operation was a medical officer with a flair for accounting who okayed pulses and checked the figures of the tally clerk. As soon as enough unconscious men had been collected in the ambulances, the medical officer signaled the bandmaster to strike up the band and end the parade. One behind the other, the squadrons marched up the field, executed a cumbersome turn around the reviewing stand, and marched down the field and back to their barracks. Each of the parading squadrons was graded as it marched past the reviewing stand, where a bloated colonel with a big fat mustache sat with the other officers. The best squadron in each wing won a yellow pennant on a pole that was utterly worthless. The best squadron on the base won a red pennant on a longer pole that was worth even less, since the pole was heavier and was that much more of a nuisance to lug around all week until some other squadron won it the following Sunday. To Yossarian, the idea of pennants as prizes was absurd. No money went with them, no class privileges. Like Olympic medals and tennis trophies, all they signified was that the owner had done something of no benefit to anyone more capably than everyone else. The parades themselves seemed equally absurd. Yossarian hated a parade. Parades were so martial. He hated hearing them, hated seeing them, hated being tied up in traffic by them. He hated being made to take part in them. It was bad enough being an aviation cadet without having to act like a soldier in the blistering heat every Sunday afternoon. It was bad enough being an aviation cadet because it was obvious now that the war would not be over before he had finished his training. That was the only reason he had volunteered for cadet training in the first place. As a soldier who had qualified for aviation cadet training, he had weeks and weeks of waiting for assignment to a class, weeks and weeks more to become a bombardier navigator, weeks and weeks more of operational training after that to prepare him for overseas duty. It seemed inconceivable, then, that the war could last that long, for God was on his side, he had been told, and God, he had also been told, could do whatever he wanted to. But the war was not nearly over, and his training was almost complete. Lieutenant Shishkov longed desperately to win parades, and sat up half the night working on it while his wife waited amorously for him in bed, thumbing through Kraft Ebbing to her favorite passages. He read books on marching. He manipulated boxes of chocolate soldiers until they melted in his hands, and then maneuvered in ranks of 12, a set of plastic cowboys he had bought from a mail-order house under an assumed name and kept locked away from everyone's eyes during the day. Leonardo's exercises in anatomy proved indispensable. One evening he felt the need for a live model and directed his wife to march around the room.
"Naked?"
she asked hopefully. Lieutenant Shishkov smacked his hands over his eyes in exasperation. It was the despair of Lieutenant Shishkov's life to be chained to a woman who was incapable of looking beyond her own dirty sexual desires to the titanic struggles for the unattainable in which noble man could become heroically engaged.
"Why don't you ever whip me?"
she pouted one night.
"Because I haven't the time," he snapped at her impatiently. "I haven't the time."
"Don't you know there's a parade going on?"
And he really did not have the time. There it was, Sunday already, with only 7 days left in the week to get ready for the next parade. He had no idea where the hours went. Finishing last in three successive parades had given Lieutenant Shishkov an unsavory reputation, and he considered every means of improvement, even nailing the 12 men in each rank to a long 2x4 beam of seasoned oak to keep them in line. The plan was not feasible, for making a 90-degree turn would have been impossible without nickel alloy swivels inserted in the small of every man's back, and Lieutenant Shishkov was not sanguine at all about obtaining that many nickel alloy swivels from Quartermaster or enlisting the cooperation of the surgeons at the hospital. The week after Lieutenant Shishkov followed Clevenger's recommendation and let the men elect their own cadet officers, the squadron won the yellow pennant. Lieutenant Shishkov was so elated by this unexpected achievement that he gave his wife a sharp crack over the head with the pole when she tried to drag him into bed to celebrate by showing their contempt for the sexual mores of the lower middle classes in Western civilization. The next week, the squadron won the red flag, and Lieutenant Shishkov was beside himself with rapture. And the week after that, his squadron made history by winning the red pennant 2 weeks in a row. Now Lieutenant Shishkov had confidence enough in his powers to spring his big surprise. Lieutenant Shishkov had discovered in his extensive research that the hands of marchers, instead of swinging freely, as was then the popular fashion, ought never to be moved more than 3 inches from the center of the thigh, which meant, in effect, that they were scarcely to be swung at all. Lieutenant Shishkov's preparations were elaborate and clandestine. All the cadets in his squadron were sworn to secrecy and rehearsed in the dead of night on the auxiliary parade ground. They marched in darkness that was pitch and bumped into each other blindly, but they did not panic, and they were learning to march without swinging their hands. Lieutenant Shishkov's first thought had been to have a friend of his in the sheet metal shop sink pegs of nickel alloy into each man's thigh bones and link them to the wrists by strands of copper wire with exactly 3 inches of play. But there wasn't time. There was never enough time, and good copper wire was hard to come by in wartime. He remembered also that the men, so hampered, would be unable to fall properly during the impressive fainting ceremony preceding the marching, and that an inability to faint properly might affect the unit's rating as a whole. And all week long he chortled with repressed delight at the officers' club. Speculation grew rampant among his closest friends.
"I wonder what that shithead is up to," Lieutenant Engel said.
Lieutenant Shishkov responded with a knowing smile to the queries of his colleagues.
"You'll find out Sunday," he promised. "You'll find out."
Lieutenant Shishkov unveiled his epical surprise that Sunday with all the aplomb of an experienced impresario. He said nothing while the other squadrons ambled past the reviewing stand crookedly in their customary manner. He gave no sign even when the first ranks of his own squadron hove into sight with their swingless marching and the first stricken gasps of alarm were hissing from his startled fellow officers. He held back even then, until the bloated colonel with the big fat mustache whirled upon him savagely with a purpling face, and then he offered the explanation that made him immortal.
"Look, Colonel," he announced, "no hands."
And to an audience stilled with awe, he distributed certified photostatic copies of the obscure regulation on which he had built his unforgettable triumph. This was Lieutenant Shishkov's finest hour. He won the parade, of course, hands down, obtaining permanent possession of the red pennant and ending the Sunday parades altogether, since good red pennants were as hard to come by in wartime as good copper wire. Lieutenant Shishkov was made first Lieutenant Shishkov on the spot and began his rapid rise through the ranks. There were few who did not hail him as a true military genius for his important discovery.
"That Lieutenant Shishkov," Lieutenant Travers remarked, "is a military genius."
"Yes, he really is," Lieutenant Engel agreed. "It's a pity the schmuck won't whip his wife."
"I don't see what that has to do with it,"
Lieutenant Travers answered coolly.
"Lieutenant Bemis whips Mrs. Bemis beautifully every time they have sexual intercourse, and he isn't worth a farthing at parades."
"I'm talking about flagellation," Lieutenant Engel retorted. "Who gives a damn about parades?"
Actually, No one but Lieutenant Shishkov really gave a damn about the parades, least of all the bloated colonel with a big fat mustache, who was chairman of the action board, and began bellowing at Clevenger the moment Clevenger stepped gingerly into the room to plead innocent to the charges Lieutenant Shishkov had lodged against him. The colonel beat his fist down upon the table and hurt his hand, and became so further enraged with Clevenger that he beat his fist down upon the table even harder and hurt his hand some more. Lieutenant Shishkov glared at Clevenger with tight lips, mortified by the poor impression Clevenger was making.
"In 60 days, you'll be fighting Billy Patrol," the colonel with a big fat mustache roared. "And you think it's a big fat joke?"
"I don't think it's a joke, sir," Clevenger replied.
"Don't interrupt!"
"Yes, sir."
"And say sir when you do," ordered Major Metcalf.
"Yes, sir." "Weren't you just ordered not to interrupt?"
Major Metcalf inquired coldly.
"But I didn't interrupt, sir," Clevenger protested.
"No, and you didn't say sir, either. Add that to the charges against him," Major Metcalf directed the corporal who could take shorthand. "Failure to say sir to superior officers when not interrupting them."
"Metcalf,"
said the colonel.
"You're a goddamn fool, do you know that?"
Major Metcalf swallowed with difficulty.
"Yes, sir."
"Now keep your goddamn mouth shut! You don't make sense!"
There were three members of the action board, the bloated colonel with the big fat mustache, Lieutenant Shishkov, and Major Metcalf, who was trying to develop a steely gaze. As a member of the action board, Lieutenant Shishkov was one of the judges who would weigh the merits of the case against Clevenger as presented by the prosecution. Lieutenant Shishkov was also the prosecutor. Clevenger had an officer defending him. The officer defending him was Lieutenant Shishkov. It was all very confusing to Clevenger, who began vibrating in terror as the colonel surged to his feet like a gigantic belch and threatened to rip his stinking, cowardly body apart limb from limb. One day he had stumbled while marching to class. The next day he was formally charged with breaking ranks while in formation, felonious assault, indiscriminate behavior, mopery, high treason, provoking, being a smart guy, listening to classical music, and so on. In short, they threw the book at him. And there he was, standing in dread before the bloated colonel, who roared once more that in 60 days he would be fighting Billy Patrol, and demanded to know how the hell he would like being washed out and shipped to the Solomon Islands to bury bodies. Clevenger replied with courtesy that he would not like it. He was a dope who would rather be a corpse than bury one. The colonel sat down and settled back, calm and cagey suddenly, and ingratiatingly polite.
"What did you mean," he inquired slowly, "when you said we couldn't punish you?"
"When, sir?"
"I'm asking the questions. You're answering them."
"Yes, sir, I..."
"Did you think we brought you here to ask questions and for me to answer them?"
"No, sir, I..."
"What did we bring you here for?"
"To answer questions."
"You're goddamn right!" roared the colonel. "Now suppose you start answering some, or I break your goddamn head. Just what the hell did you mean, you bastard, when you said we couldn't punish you?"
"I don't think I ever made that statement, sir."
"Will you speak up, please? I couldn't hear you."
"Yes, sir, I..." "Will you speak up, please? He couldn't hear you." "Yes, sir, I..."
"Metcalf!"
"Sir?"
"Didn't I tell you to keep your stupid mouth shut?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then keep your stupid mouth shut when I tell you to keep your stupid mouth shut. Do you understand?"
"Will you speak up, please? I couldn't hear you." "Yes, sir, I..."
"Metcalf! Is that your foot I'm stepping on?"
"No, sir, it must be Lieutenant Shishkov's foot."
"It isn't my foot," said Lieutenant Shishkov.
"Then maybe it is my foot, after all," said Major Metcalf.
"Move it!"
"Yes, sir. You'll have to move your foot first, Colonel. It's on top of mine."
"Are you telling me to move my foot?"
"No, sir. Oh, no, sir."
"Then move your foot and keep your stupid mouth shut. Will you speak up, please? I still couldn't hear you."
"Yes, sir. I said that I didn't say that you couldn't punish me."
Just what the hell are you talking about?
I'm answering your question.